Oh, right, right, right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. We would absolutely come. Sorry. I was feeling cynical, I suppose.
Okay, yes.
Which is, I know you're usually the cynical one, Ken, and usually I'm the chipper, upbeat, relaxed one.
You're the true optimist among the two of us.
Exactly. It could always get worse, listener. It could always get worse. There can always be a fifth chair projection.
Yes, exactly. The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in New England, and I'm joined, as I am, just about every fortnight by Ken Holyoke, who has recently returned to Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
I'm back from the mountains, and I'm about to head to the sea, basically.
That's right. And I understand you have an ice cream recommendation or a gelato recommendation for our listeners.
Yeah. So I should pull that up, actually.
I should have warned you about this. We do these as fairly organic openings, but you'd sent me a picture of you, I think, eating a dairy-free rhubarb something or other.
Yeah. So Bean Pod Chocolate in Fernie. They make their own...
Fernie, British Columbia, right?
Yes, Fernie, British Columbia. So it's right up in the mountains, just about like 20 minutes from the Alberta border, basically. Ski town in the winter, and then the summer, there's lots of people to go hiking and mountain biking and stuff like that there. So we were there for the weekend. Anyway, excellent gelato. I had some dairy and some non-dairy, but their rhubarb.
Very brave.
I had my lactees with me, so that.
Yes.
Take four and enjoy your dairy delight. Anyway, Bean Pod Chocolate. So they make all their own chocolate from bean, but then they also have a gelato place, and both delicious.
Fantastic. Did you hike? Did you bike? What'd you do?
We went for a very nice hike to Fairy Creek Falls. The water in the river was very charged up because they've had some rain and all the snow melting. And so pretty dramatic, but very, very pretty.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that sounds all right.
Yeah. And had some tapas, Latin American food last night.
Oh, good. I'm just going to let the listener know, by the way, that hiking is foreshadowing one of our prize right here.
But you go.
Yeah, tell us about the tapas. What did you top?
Geez, we had a tostada, a very fancy tostada.
That's funny. I was in last time I had a tostada. It was not a tapas. It was the size of a pizza.
Well, so this one was like was tapas sized. It was definitely like reduced in size, but very delicious, very fresh tasting. Had some fried plantains. A couple of very good mezcal cocktails. As a table, we split a pitcher of margaritas too, and they do very well. So yeah,
good.
Anyway, the food in Fernie is very good for those of you who are looking to go up into the mountains.
Okay, well, this is good to know. I had not actually heard about Fernie until you texted.
Yeah. So now you know.
Yeah. Well, and Ken, we are at the moment sponsored. I think. Well, don't worry, Manuel. We'll check and tell you where to send your invoice. But we think we're sponsored by the University of New Brunswick at the moment. Is that right?
I believe that is correct. I think the Faculty of Arts. Would that be correct?
I think that's correct. Yeah. And again, we'll resolve this on the. We'll make sure you get paid, Manuel.
Exactly. Judy's got you.
Yeah, we have a list of people we're not sponsored by. I could read those too, but and Ken, you mentioned going to the mountains, and I'd like the listener to keep that in mind here for a second. But we're still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And, you know, one of the things as I reflect on this that's kind of interesting about that is neither of us are in New Brunswick right now.
No, I will be soon. But we rarely
are. Many of our listeners aren't in New Brunswick either.
That's true. Global audience.
This is sort of an odd name for a podcast, isn't it?
it always has been. I think it was always meant to be temporary.
That's right. Yeah. But it's funny, Ken. Do you ever reflect? Do you think, wouldn't it be nice if somebody wrote in and they just had a new name? I mean, we get lots of good email, but if someone had a great new name for this podcast,
I think that would be excellent.
Yeah, and it would be great if they just wrote in, because we wouldn't need to compensate them.
That's true. Yep, we could. We would compensate them though, because we are gracious and appreciate people's intellectual property.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. We would absolutely comp. Sorry. I was feeling cynical, I suppose.
Okay. Yes.
Which is, I know you're usually the cynical one, Ken, and usually I'm the chipper, upbeat, relaxed one.
You're
the true optimist among
the two of us.
Exactly, exactly. It could always get worse, listener. It could always get worse. There can always be a fifth jerk rejection.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But Ken, that's fascinating. You mentioned that. Yeah, we would reimburse them, and so Ken, why don't you, while I figure out how we would reimburse them, why don't you tell them where they would send that new name for this podcast?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you could also send us a message on Instagram @new_brunswick_archaeology and archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And so, Ken, we've got a very exciting show lined up for the listener. We're going to be talking about Prince Edward Island, aren't we?
We are. Yes. It's a New Brunswick Archaeology podcast, but we're moving across the Confederation Bridge today.
That's right. We are. And do you like PEI?
I love PEI. Yeah. Great beaches. All right. Very, very drivable. Excellent seafood.
Yeah. Fantastic. And like Anne of Green Gables said, it's been my experience that you can nearly always enjoy things if you make up your mind firmly that you will, Ken. And that's actually the attitude we encourage the listener to take with this very podcast. Isn't that right?
That is very true.
Yeah, and as we just indicated, Ken, we're both interested in reimbursing the listener who might come in with a new name for this podcast. And Ken, as John Moore said, the mountains are calling. And as Hunter S. Thompson said, quote, we had 2 bags of grass, 75 pellets of mescaline, 5 sheets of high-powered blotter acid, a salt shaker hat and a half full of cocaine, and a whole galaxy of multicolored uppers, downers, screamers, laughers, and also a quart of tequila, a quart of rum, a case of Budweiser, a pint of raw ether, and 2 dozen amyls. Not that we needed all that for the trip, but once you get locked into a serious drug collection, the tendency is to push it as far as you can. And Ken, I suppose by now you've probably gathered what we're giving away to the lucky listener.
I hope it's legal.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Ken. The lucky listener who renames this podcast, we're going to give some xenon gas. It's colorless, it's odorless, and it's inert. It's apparently a performance-enhancing drug, and it's the subject of some controversy in the climbing community because of its potential to increase the production of red blood cells, and along with it, the blood's oxygen-carrying ability.
Huh.
It's also an anesthetic that can dull pain while you climb. And you may have heard recently these properties have made it a controversial addition to the Mountaineer's kit. And you may have seen the story of 4 British climbers who did Everest, aided by xenon gas, which helped them ascend, and also to avoid the time climbers usually need to spend in Kathmandu, Nepal, and then Everest Base Camp in order to acclimate. Did you catch that story?
I missed that one. Didn't end up on my feed.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, people are fairly annoyed about this because it's you know, now it's just, can anyone just do Everest, you know?
Right.
But Ken, let's set xenon gas aside for a moment. I gather these guys were ex-British Special Forces, so we're not going to start off with Everest ourselves, and along with a lucky listener, but we've got a similar experience planned. That's right, Ken. The Everest of the Maritimes, the K2 of Confederation. Jones Hill. Towering over the village of Alexandria at 85 meters above sea level, or 27 imperial cubits, we might pause to ask why we, along with our listeners, would attempt such a daring feat of mountaineering right there in Prince Edward Island. It's because of the scientific contributions of attempting such a venture? Is it because mountains give clarity to the chaos? Is it to achieve a spiritual experience only attainable at the limits of human physical ability? Is it simply, Ken, because Jones Hill is there? Well, Ken, I'd argue it's all of those things. And now, Ken, ordinarily an expedition in PEI like this would take weeks. We'd depart Fredericton with our gear and meet our Sherpas in Charlottetown, and we'd spend a whole week there adjusting to altitude before we shifted our base camp to Paulnow, PEI. But, Ken, that was before xenon gas. Now we'll just spend a leisurely 4 days in Charlottetown with our team, enjoying Malpeque oysters, fries with the works, and martini made with ocean pearl gin. And Ken, we would never send our listeners on an expedition like this, that's 85 meters, Ken, above sea level, without proper gear. So during this acclimation period, we're also going to make sure they have the right gear for this arduous journey. Specialized equipment like comfortable walking shoes, a Tilly hat, sunglasses, and at least one water bottle. And sometimes, you know, Ken, even the xenon gas, it can get a little chilly at altitude. You know, like it dulls pain, but you want to be careful not to get too cold.
Exactly.
So we're going to make sure they're equipped with a custom New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast limited edition midweight windbreaker. And Ken, It's expedition day. After a hearty breakfast at Leonard's Cafe and Restaurant, it's time to start inhaling that noble gas and summiting Jones Hill.
This is what it's going to happen. So how is it that they ingest this xenon gas? Is it like they just huff it out of a can, or what's going on here?
You know, Ken, so I spent some time trying to research this and figure out the exact details of that. And I think you basically take it out of like a, you know, like the oxygen thing that like EMTs have in the back,
yeah,
back of a rig. Yeah, I think it's that.
Huh.
But anyway, once we've inhaled it, Ken, along with a lucky listener, we're going to summit Jones Hill. And Ken, as Sir Edmund Hillary supposedly said, it's not the mountains we conquer, but ourselves.
That's
And so, Ken,
that's very true.
Where would the lucky listener who renames this podcast and is going to go on the expedition of a lifetime, aided by the latest pharmaceutical enhancement, performance-enhancing drugs, send that new name for this podcast?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's newbrunswickarchaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right, listener. And Ken, if you reach your hand into that mailbag, what do you find?
I find just my hand. There's nothing new here. In fact, we haven't really even had an email come in since our scheduled maintenance on May 10th email from Apple Podcasts. So,
you know, Ken, I don't want to tell you, but there's something alarming about not getting any emails after scheduled maintenance, isn't that?
Well, there's a lot of spam stuff, but they move Google now sorts our spam. So all the Squarespace emails and actually now someone's from Mitsubishi Motors Canada are getting sorted into the promotions one. Which is, you know, it's very kind of them. Oh, we have a new subscriber on YouTube, actually. Kimber Sneeze has subscribed to us.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Kimber. Thank you for subscribing, Kimber Sneeze.
All right. Well, Ken, this is an episode coming up that I think is sure to attract more listener mail. And I actually wasn't there for all of it, so I'm excited to listen to this, too.
Yeah. So today we've got Christian Terrio, who is the provincial archaeologist in Prince Edward Island. And we are also joined by Helen Christmanson, who is the senior archaeologist for Illinois, the Mi'kmaq organization in PEI, and former provincial archaeologist as well. And so we have discussion with Christian about basically regulation and managing archaeology in PEI, and Helen sort of shares her perspective working with Mi'kmaq groups, and also a little bit of kind of an interesting, I think you'll like the part where we dive into some of the early archaeology of PEI, natural historians landing themselves on the island to take part in digs.
Is it like Jesse Fuchs and those people?
Jesse Fuchs, yeah, that's the one.
So, all right,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, so Jesse Fuchs makes it an appearance, and so listener, we'll talk to you at the other side.
We'll talk to you soon, listener.
Okay, we are joined today by Christian Terrio, who is the provincial archaeologist in Prince Edward Island in the Department of Fisheries, Tourism, and Culture. Christian has an MA in anthropology from University of New Brunswick and a Diplôme d'études universitaire générale and a licence en archéologie classique from Université Marc Bloch in Strasbourg, France. Christian has also worked on the Gallo-Roman theater of Mandur and the Oppidum du Fossé des Pandours. I probably mispronounced that.
The listener will notice we're letting Ken do this to work on his bilingualism.
A Celtic center in Saverne, France. He's also worked in archaeology for the better part of 20 plus years, having done CRM in both public and private sectors throughout the Canadian Maritimes, Quebec, and British Columbia. His research interests are primarily geoarchaeological, and he was the principal investigator of the Upsilquitch Forks Archaeological Survey, a project that mapped out several potential sources for Ordovician-age cherts throughout north central and west central New Brunswick, complicating some of our understanding where rocks come from. But having hauled a very large one up a giant hill, I can say that it's very beautiful rock, the area is very beautiful, and the maple sugar from the Terrio sugar bush is top-notch. So, bienvenue au balado d'archéologie du Nouveau-Brunswick. Christian, thank you for coming on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. Welcome.
Thanks for joining us, Christian. Christian, we were wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about, you're the new provincial archaeologist at PEI, and so what do you do? What's that job entail? And what are your responsibilities there in PEI?
I'm going to go broad and like go like smaller things after. But the main thing is I'm manage the archaeology and paleontology for the island, as both are part of the archaeology act. So I'm pretty much responsible to make sure that follow the act, the archaeology act of Prince Edward Island. So yeah, that includes Well, before, because yeah, in Prince Edward Island, like I'm responsible for like most of the field work, for example, or regulations, guiding, advising government towards anything relating to archaeology and paleontology, which I'm slowly learning for the Permian period in here, because there's a lot of paleontology happening on the island, which people are not really aware of. You might have seen some in the news recently,
There's like dino tracks in PEI,
tracks and tetrapods, but yeah, it's one of the three hotspots for the Permian period in the world, with the Southwest US and Germany. So more and more scientists are coming over, and there's also part of the island was a Carboniferous.
Yep.
And they have some of those giant insects from that period, recently, a vocational paleontologist found a wing of a dragonfly.
Oh, cool.
Like a giant dragonfly, and it's being researched in France, in Paris right now.
This is the first episode of the New Brunswick Paleontology podcast.
I was going to say, as soon as Ken heard Carboniferous, I thought I saw a helicopter lowering outside of his window to pick him up and take him to PEI.
Looking for that sweet, sweet, sweet red shirt.
Yeah. So you handle
Yeah, I know. There's no shirts. There are no shirts, though. There's a fine minute, they describe it as a fine gray white that they have used, they were using, for example, in some sites like Meminegash. It's pretty rough material, but other than that, there's none. Yeah. Well, there might be some inclusion that we can find in the glacial deposits, but nothing that I know.
Are you doing research on a day-to-day basis out there, too?
Yeah. Well, trying to get the reports, some reports done right now, and also we're working on guidelines and standard for the island, but yeah, I'll answer to that later on. It's a good question, but that's, yeah, because moment, PI has been using the New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, a little bit of what the other provinces are doing, but we don't really have, our guidelines and standard for the archaeological work. We do have an act and regulations, but no guidelines.
And the act is actually called the Archaeology Act, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, even though it includes paleontology, but the plan in the future is to have a paleontologist giving how much discoveries are being made. And yeah, we usually have somebody on contract because I'm not really I've learned a lot about it and I know, but I won't call myself a paleontologist and I wouldn't know what to do, if to properly preserve a fossil and all that.
Okay, cool. Well, it's exciting though. So it sounds like your office will probably expand over time to include some other folks as well.
We'll see.
So you're responsible for, you're doing some research work, you're basically a regulator for both archaeology and paleontology, and this is a pretty new position for you. You've been on the job now for about a year and a half or so, or a little bit more maybe?
Yeah, I got in as a replacement in 2022,
okay,
August.
So it's been a couple of years now.
I think it was 2022, time goes by, so...
Yeah. You should just check the scratch marks on his wall.
So what were you kind of most excited to tackle out of the gate, working in PEI, and what are some of the long-term projects that you're involved in, through your office or that who you're partnering with?
My first job when I got on the island, I was go to and organize all the data we had, all the reports, all the manuscripts, and also all the databases. So going through that and organizing that has been my first few months on the job. And it was very interesting because everything I would find, I would read through. So you're learning a lot about the archaeology of the island, which is a little, there's a lot of the great literature of the island, as you would call it. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel I get the sense that PEI actually has a lot more kind of deep cut archaeology that we haven't really read about because it's been mostly technical reports and things like that. But that, there's some really fascinating stuff. I mean, you've shared with us some of the things that you've been working on, some of the things you find. So you're doing this deep dive, you're kind of doing the literature review. And my understanding too is you've been working on digitization and that kind of stuff as well.
The goal is, I've been organizing the database to have a relational database of sites, but also everything that's connected to the sites, site visits, what report. Which report, which site just mentioned in which report, everything I've everything connected together, and I try and understand better as time goes, because that's long-term very long-term project, trying to understand how sites are connected and what materials they use, and I have a better understanding of when and where people went and all the that changed with the landscape changing around, because as we know, like the island is slow, like, well, not even slowly, fastly rolling away.
Yeah. So actually, we didn't put this on the list of questions and kind of probably made a big error there. So can you give people kind of the listener sort of just a broad overview of sort of the history of PEI, like what, you know, how, what's the oldest site, you know, who were the first people to arrive on the island, and what's the kind of a broad strokes, what the culture history, I guess, is in PEI.
Start more recently than the Carboniferous.
So we know there were bugs there 250 million years ago, but what was next? So,
well, there's, as you know, in the north, there was a discovery that was made, I think it was in the 30s and 50s, that a farmer found a projectile point in this field up in the North Tryon that could potentially be it's a fluted point, but it's out of context. So we don't, like, all we have is one artifact. As Kevin Leonard pointed out, that it could have come from, like, because people were, at the time, and like historically, they were digging out shell middens, shells out of the bays to put in the field, like farming. So there's a potential that we don't know the context of when the artifact was found. There's a potential that artifact could have come from there.
Yeah.
And other finds, like, do we have a few other isolated finds on the island that could also be from fields that could also be the people who's, because, yeah, they were literally digging out shell middens to put in the field. And, that's something, yeah, Dale talks about it in his new book.
That's interesting.
About people, like, digging out shell middens to put them in the, yeah.
Talks about mining shell middens.
There's a big history of that in PEI, yeah.
To be used as fertilizer, basically, eh? And I think in PEI, too, we're also using it as, like road gravel in the winter, for traction and stuff like that is what I remember. Cause I remember reading about this. I've done some consulting work in PEI, as you know, and some of it was actually because of this find, and they were doing a highway twinning in the Tryon area. And so we did a bunch of archaeology there because of this, this potential for encountering. And I remember reading about this, not just for fertilizer, but also like for a variety of different purposes.
Yeah, so you can cook it for lime too.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe that's what it was that they, like, for the lime, and then use that on as like a road.
Yeah. Lynn Sickey, or however you say your last name, CECI, wrote an article in 1984 about this all over the Northeast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Kind of a cool, it's actually sitting on my desk right now. I just read it yesterday. So
I've always pronounced it CC.
I actually don't know what's right, but she unfortunately died quite young. Isn't with us anymore. Okay, so the Paleo-Indian period, Christian, then you want to, like, kind of walk us
through? Well, there's a potentially one, but we don't, that's the only object that we know of that could be from that period is up
and
there.
And sorry, just to interrupt briefly, at that point, PEI is still linked to New Brunswick, right? It's still...
Yeah, everything is connected until around 5,000.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, at that time, it's not really, it's partially connected. If you look at the old, like, the map, like, there's a blockage. The water and the part of the island is still called.
Yeah. The landmass sort of grows. So for the listener, basically, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and PEI were much more connected, not through a bridge and ferry traffic, but like actual landmass, sort of along the Northumberland Strait. And it sort of begins around 13,000-ish years ago, but it kind of grows in size until about 8,000 years ago, and then it starts to shrink again. And so around 5,000, you said that the Northumberland Strait became what it is today.
Well, between 9 and 5,000, because the water would have risen after, like, when the glacier melted, but as the with the isostatic rebound, like, then it would have...
Yeah.
Well, the land would have gone up, and then the water levels would have been going down, so that's... And then it went up again later on, around 5,000.
And given the theme of this podcast, we'll cut Christian off when he starts to talk about the late archaic. We just won't. once it's not the New Brunswick archaeology podcast anymore, that'll be the... So possible Paleo-Indian, and then we move into the late Paleo-Indian, early archaic?
Well, we have a potential planet point. Like, actually, I was talking to Ken about that. That was found in the thing of farmers. Like, it's range farming with somebody's, like, garden. That's, and actually Dale also mentions that piece in his book. Seems to have been reworked, like they worked a notch into it, but it would have been a planal point. And the material seems to fit because it looks like the material they would have been using, for example, Quebec. Like, it looks like some Appalachian chert or rhyolite. Yeah, sadly that location has been highly altered since, but so it wasn't, like, there's no context for it. It's just a surface mined by a local.
Yeah. And the notching, I might be misremembering this, but it's thought that maybe that the object was like curated and notched later on, rather than notched during.
Yeah, well, that deals interpretation. Like, they would have like found more, that's interesting too, because people would have found like projectile points in the past and probably just reworked them to like the way that they
would want to use it.
They would have used them, like they put a notch to it, and then why spend the time making a point when you just found one that's like, yeah, it just needs a little rework, and you can go ahead.
Just take that Salutrian point, you flute the bottom, and then you're back in business.
Yeah. So into the Archaic, we're talking about, like, there would have been a lot more of PEI, basically, that people would have been living on. And so where are we finding?
Yeah, well, look, with a connection, there's a lot from, like most sites on the island, it's mostly on the north shore and on the east shores all the way to Murray Harbor. So from Murray Harbor to Kaskumpek Bay, pretty much, where most of all the bays, where all the sites are less subject to erosion due to the dune systems and the bays that protects the sites, while on the southern part, like in Northern Merlin Strait, most of us, the few sites we have are further, well, for example, there's Miminagash that was protected by a dune, but otherwise, like, most of the bays are there's no such protection. So everything, like most of the site appears to have eroded away. And the few artifacts, actually, somebody reported one to me a few days ago, like the ones that people find on the beaches are like highly water rolled. So you can tell that, sites are, well, I don't know if you're familiar with the southern shore of the island. A lot of those beaches on the Northumberland Strait, like, you all have, like, yeah, you can walk in the water for like a very long distance, and then it goes down. So there's a plateau that where the land was connected. So
it's like a really gradual.
Just imagine lowering the water level a few meters, and then all that is land.
Yeah,
and it's all covered
in
water.
So this is the thing: is like the archaeological record in PEI is kind of characterized by sort of erosion, right? So you've got these early landscapes that are completely underwater because of just sort of natural processes, but then you've also got this ongoing. You know, it's built on sandstone and it's mostly sand. And so you have natural erosion going on, but that's, this is becoming kind of an increased problem. And some of your work has been centered around coastal erosion, in particular what's happening right now. And some of this is climate change driven. So, can you tell us a little bit about that?
First project that I did working on the island was to do a survey around like certain locations around the island after Fiona to see the impact of it. And it was pretty devastating, but surprisingly, a lot of new sites that were found, like the one in Miminagash, but there was also like a lot of areas that I visited, like talking to collector and all that, where they would have been, where they've been collected for a long time, and they, like even the year prior to that. And even me, like I did a survey just like a few months prior to that in the Rustico. And when I went after Fiona, a lot of those sites were just covered with seaweed and other sediments. So visibility after the storms, for example, some areas where the dunes are, and the site gets cut through the dune, like the dune site and the north of the island and then the one in Miminagash, then those sites were highly exposed. But sites that have like a low grade and usually would have been by sediments. And talking to the collectors, I've been doing that for 10, 20, 30 years. Like they say, like usually you have to wait a few years after a big storm like that to start finding like artifacts on the beaches again, as like the waves just take that sand and then exposes the objects that have just been And even that, even like the few sites, often the sites that I would find in that context would have been large ground stones that the waves, like the larger wave, couldn't move around. They just stayed in place while all the flakes and anything else around there were just.
So are we seeing a pattern on PEI like we do elsewhere in the region, where it's the oldest sites that are getting eroded first? Or is it a different pattern where we actually have interior sites now sites that were once interior getting hit by coastal erosion because it's that bad?
When the site was occupied, from what I understand, it was an estuary site and not a coastal site. It's just that the dune have been receding to a point that now it's reached where the estuary was, but the site was more like would have been linked to the river rather than the coast. It's hard to tell, but just looking at the old aerials from the area and talking to the locals, like the dunes have been moving backwards like for quite a time. Like that one, actually, we had the date for it because of there was actually like a sheep that died under the, like, before the dune fall over, so we can tell that dune was 200 years old.
Oh, really? Oh, that's kind of, I mean, it's sort of fortuitous that you just had like an animal you could date inside the dune.
Not everyone knows, but actually PI is dated by these, it's stratigraphically dated by dead sheep. It's just sand, like, dead sheep, sand, dead yeah. sheep. And you,
But so that's kind of interesting. So what like in terms of the pace? So this is like a 200-year-old sheep, and like how far has the dune migrated over that time?
Well, that actually, the sadly over there, the dune is disappearing because there's not much left dune left, and it can't move back more because then you have the water courses there now, and then past that it's just development. So once that dune is gone, it's gonna be like the rest of that the southern shoreline is gonna be gone.
And so for the listener, the dunes kind of act like almost like a natural armor around some of these archaeological sites. And so the real challenge is that as these dunes get obliterated with big storms, but kind of wear down or get pinched, like in Min-Magash, where you've got the dune is pushed back and then you've got a river and then you've got development on the other side of it. So it's kind of like there's sort of this pressure on all fronts. And so you're kind of one person in an office, and you get a, like, do you get a sense of how you're going to tackle these challenges moving forward? Like, is it some?
Yeah, well, like what I've been working on, like there's been different projects. Like we often find like objects on the shoreline, but it's not always obvious where the actual site is. So trying to understand like what's, because sometimes like, yeah, like is it coming from the beach itself or is it from further back and it's eroding into the beach recently? Like some. We had some interesting project, like some project in the past where, like, we just, like, for example, like there was one recently where they had doing a CM work in an area that used, like, until 1850, there used to be a train going there, like the station with a ship, with a yard and all the, like, no sign of that now. And that's late 19th century. So, like, try to imagine, and some of those high impact from the erosion, like, are they just, is it just buried under sand or is it completely gone? Like sometimes.
So it's impacting, it's not just like indigenous stuff. Like there's like a historical record that's also disappearing. Like
like Acadian sites are pretty like hard to find. And a lot of them, for example, might be gone. And then there's the Basque question, like where are all the settlements that are left behind?
That's really interesting. What are some of the major, what kind of projects are going on at PI right now? Is there, I know there's a CRM industry. Are there, what's that like? Are there people doing professional work or academic work in the province?
There's a few CRM projects on the go, but not happening during the year, but they're not many compared to the other provinces. Like there's like between 3 and 10 projects every year, depending on.
Is that just the size of PEI?
Depends on what type of work they do, because it's usually like it'd be like bridge work, wharfs, like they'd be like wharf or roads, windmills, and shoreline protection is a big one too. Well, they do the, like, yeah, when you build those walls, then we'll need to have somebody do the monitoring or testing, depending on.
If we've got a graduate student listening, what sort of thesis topic should they be considering doing at PEI? I'm getting.
Oh, there's lots of like all the erosion. There's like all the, like, depending. Yeah, there's a lots of collections that need to be looked at too as well. And there's all those little, Acadian sites, and there's also, well, I know there's some researchers that like been interested in also like the bat model I was mentioning, the Basque. You're like a researcher that's interested in coming maybe like in the coming years to to see if we can identify some of those sites. Yeah.
So if you're listening, grad students, that PEI is lovely in the summer, and it sounds like they have a lot of archaeology available to tap into. So,
and Christian Terrio is wearing a shirt that says "Get it while it lasts." That's the official motto of the Heritage Branch there in PEI, I think.
So you might not be able to speak to this, and
I encourage that we get more people coming in because there's only like football. The only like there's a few researchers from doing some work. Well, there's Ellison Harris that's been doing work on the bioarchaeological work, and there's Buchanan has always been doing some, like, a little bit of research on the, like, well, more in the past, but I think he's just gathering all the information he had before. But I encourage having more people coming in, because they are doing myself and my assistant and Elmoy and Parks. There's not much work being done other than the little CRM.
So there's a couple big national parks in PEI, and I'm guessing because of the size of the island, you guys are probably working, do you guys coordinate like working with the Parks Canada folks, or is it kind of you know, for the listener, they're two very different systems, right?
Well, yeah, it's two different. Like, they do the work on Parks and we do the rest. And Bitball, and they've been working with Elmway as well very closely. But yeah, like, I'm not sure if they did work this year, but like, I've been, yeah, Vinny usually, Vincent Bourgeois has been doing.
Very cool.
Doing the field work. So.
And so it sounds like, though, it's kind of interesting that you say that, like, there's some really fascinating archaeology and really underexplored archaeology in PEI, but it's like, of all things, it sounds like the paleontology has been what has been a real, like, research focus in the last few years, right? That it's sort of, that it's become...
Well, it's been, John Calder has been doing a lot of work. Like, if you have a chance to, read his book on the paleontology of the island, it's...
Maybe we'll put that in the show notes if we can, check.
Calder, like Calder?
Yeah, he's worked on a lot of big projects, but all around, but yeah, he's very interesting. And, he's worked, and then Matt Stimson, that's at the New Brunswick Museum, also did work, did research on the PI. And all this, there's a few other people from other province now, like I was mentioning again, the people in France, but other people from other countries are getting more and more interested because, it's all the same period that they're studying that we didn't know that, there's an avocational paleontologist actually that's been finding a lot of that material recently, and then it's been exposed.
I'd like to make a pitch that they find a T-Rex and name it Stompin' Tom. I think that would be, good. It could be New Brunswick Sioux.
There's no chance of that.
So, before we let you go here, you talked about that you're developing guidelines for the island, and you've talked about some. You've got a
Eventually, yeah, it's in project. I've barely touched the surface of that, and then eventually, and it would be like in the discussions with other groups. Like, it wouldn't just be a personal thing. It'd be like talking with everybody doing archaeology, trying to like what would be the best. More appropriate guidelines from the
But it sounds like, though, you've got pretty good relationship with avocationals and collectors on the island, and that's kind of working, and there's probably some rules around that. And so what are kind of the rules around engagement and avocational activities, and also, like, if a student is interested in doing research, or if an academic is interested in doing research, what are the kind of what's just sort of the general process for reaching out to do work in PEI? I'm guessing it's probably start with an email to Christian, but then...
Yeah, it's a more email to me or the Department of Fisheries, Tourism, Sport, and Culture. And then, they'll get who will get in me, and I'll be the one approving and saying, well, yeah, and we have an approach, like, for example, since we don't have guidelines and standard, it'd be more like, following somewhat, like, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia and Quebec, but
and how early does a researcher need to get in touch with you to facilitate fieldwork?
It depends on the project.
So sooner is better.
Because the potential for having consultation to be done depending on what the scope of the project
is. So your office coordinates probably fairly closely with Elnoué, and like, so we'll be talking to Helen Christmensen, who's the archaeologist who works for Elnoué, the Mi'kmaq representatives PEI.
Yeah, I've been in touch with, we've been in, and we have the consultation, like, protocols, and like it's in the works, but that's, and we've been talking about, like, main issues as well, like, simple, like, and I mentioned that to you, like, because me and my predecessor talking to, like, there's a lot of vocational archaeology, a lot of collectors, a lot of what we know around the island is from what collectors have been finding. But there's also like a role lately, like, for example, metal detecting and people digging around in sites, like they're not just surface collecting anymore. They're like people out there like digging and doing proper archaeology, but they're not archaeologists. They're just treasure hunting, looking for objects. So that's, we're trying to reach more to the public and like try to find better ways to enforce that.
Yeah. Sort of discourage the bad practices and encourage like engagement with your office, basically. Yeah. Eh? Like, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Try to talk to it with us. And like, for example, like, we've been like, there's a young 10-year-old girl that found two sites last year, just walking around, and she's like super interested in archaeology, and she like just walking the beaches with her mom and then discovering historic sites around.
So it sounds like you've got like you know, oodles of work to keep you busy. And you're wearing many different hats, but it sounds like really exciting stuff. So before we let you go, tell us something that you want the listener to know about PEI archaeology, or that you think is important for them to know, or that you want to kind of put a pitch out there for.
Yeah, well, context, like, it's, even though if it's on the beach and it's been like, yeah, you can pick, you pick the object, but it's, well, as you know, like, just contact the province and, or I don't know if you prefer, like, and let us know where the object come from, so that we can like know that there's a site there and we can protect it. And if you find, and also all the people digging out there for like finding Spanish coins and all those fancy historic artifacts from the, potentially past Akkadian, even early settlers, like, please let us know. Like, yeah, we have to find a way to like identify where those sites are to protect them.
And so you're not going to rain pain on like people who report stuff, but it's good for your office to know what's going on.
Yeah, but if you're turning sites into Swiss cheese, then that's a different thing. Like, because that's also something that's been happening on the island that, like, it's hard to, well, unless you find people doing it in the act, it's kind of hard to do. But like, it's,
so
you get all those important sites that are just being literally like, yeah, like, they're doing it like grid test beds into them looking for like.
So the message is, reach out to the office. We'll put your email address in the show notes so that, if somebody's listening, they know who to contact.
Yeah, you can just call.
Is there like an archaeology hotline that they can call, or is it basically just?
No. Just an email to either my personal email, but there's all like archaeology@gov.pe.ca.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
They can usually like anything relating, most of the emails we got for is relates to paleontology, but it's also like we got one recently that somebody just found an artifact on the shoreline. Yeah, actually, that somebody had found something in the 90s, but they just like seeing us, like somebody talked, like we talked about it in the news, and there was more like, and they were, oh, maybe I should report that. And it's never too late because there was no, that's a new site. So now we know that there's something there that we should.
Except in the case of coastal erosion, and then it's too late. Sometimes,
but they should.
Yeah, but that's the other thing too. Like, there's also
but they should include, take a picture, probably, you know, note the location, and maybe like kind of a general description of where they found it, and send it in an email.
And usually, like, or if they're not sure, like, just send an email, and I'll get in contact and let you know what to do.
Great,
excellent.
And there's a lot of it often. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of like things that are nothing, but if it's something, especially with fossils, like it's often they're just, it's a nice rock, but that's all it is. But it's better to save than sorry.
But the listener will want to know, Christian loves to see pictures of rocks. So send the rocks anyway, and he'll let you know whether it's a fossil or an artifact. So, thank you, Christian, for coming on. We really appreciate it. It's great to have you on. You're actually our first provincial archaeologist to be on the podcast, and so we really appreciate highlighting the role that you guys play in protecting heritage and managing heritage, and I think it's great to get a perspective from PEI as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to do from just answering, like responding to the public and advising government and maintaining all the data and organizing, like, and then you have to, like, when you do more shoreline survey, you still gonna analyze everything and then like write the reports, and which a lot of them are in the process of written right now, but it seems like there's always something going on. So
fantastic.
Like, well, big storms, there's been a few big projects, and we also had a few projects in the past where we had to do shoreline protection work, and that we've been monitoring those. You see, as the years go by, every year I just revisit those sites a few times to see all things change. Like, we've been using hay bales a lot, for example, to protect the shoreline, and it seems to have been working well in the two environments where we had two different environments where we put them, and just when we had the dunes seems to be forming over. They'll erode a little bit from time to time, but the hay protects the erosion on the site surface. And the other one, which is like a higher one, when you have a mix of hay and like just cutting the trees around, just like we were talking to a local farmer and saying, yeah, we used to do that, and it's still there protecting the shoreline. So we, well, if it worked for them, it can't work for us. So. And it's been working so far. The main thing is going to be all that's going to work against like a major storm like Fiona, like next, because yeah, there's, they seem to happen more often. So that's something that we have to keep an eye on and see. Like, and there's also like a lot of different departments in government that are working on towards that too, trying to understand how to better protect the shoreline and maybe less, yeah,
right,
development around the shoreline so that we don't expose those shorelines.
This summer, if we've got a chance to bounce across the bridge there, we'll come over and maybe do an on-location podcast interview with you, and you can take us out, kind of show us some of the sites, some of the stuff you're talking about.
Hopefully by then they managed to get the cost of the bridge removed. That's in the works, but yeah. But
like, well, it'll be free to go back and forth?
Yeah, well, that's what they want. It's in the news. It's been a request, especially with what's happening right now with having more trade between provinces, that will help that.
Cool. See, was one of the positive effects of American foreign policy.
Oh, yeah, but we lost. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Christian. So much, Christian. This is great. We really appreciate it. And it's great to see you. So for those of you that Christian is a dear friend and somebody we've known for a very long time. And so Christian's taken me on many journeys through, I think it's for a different episode probably, but on many journeys through the northern woods of New Brunswick.
Yeah, we got to do one of those too again. Like, all that... we can talk about that after, but yeah, the boulder there, that's source that I've been referring to that people have been using, that we have, I'm pretty sure we've been fighting on the island
very
as
cool.
well.
Great. Very cool.
Well, thanks very much, Christian.
Thanks, Christian. Have a great day. All right. Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. We are joined today by Dr. Helen Christmanson, who is the senior archaeologist for Olniwe, which is an organization working to implement and protect the rights of PEI Mi'kmaq. Helen did her undergraduate degree at University of Calgary, and she completed graduate work at the Memorial University of Newfoundland and the University of Manchester. Prior to joining Olniwe, Dr. Christmanson was the PEI Provincial Archaeologist and Director of Aboriginal Affairs Secretariat, and prior to that, she was a consultant with the Connie River Mi'kmaq Band in Newfoundland and an ethno-archaeologist for Parks Canada. She is the author of numerous articles and chapters, especially on the topic of archaeology's significance for Indigenous rights in the legal system and on ceramic analysis in the Maritimes, PEI pre-contact history, and lithic sourcing, among others. She is also the past president of the Canadian Archaeological Association. So welcome to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, Helen. Thanks for coming on. And you might notice that there's only one voice other than Helen's today. So Gabe is in the field and unfortunately had to send his regrets today.
Hi, Ken. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I've heard all great things about what you and Gabe are doing, and it's great to see you, and sorry that I'm missing Gabe this time, but wishing him the best in the field.
Yes, and probably getting some pretty good weather. You guys finally have some good weather in the Maritimes, is that right?
It's beautiful today. Yeah, it just turned to summer, or 2 days ago.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're the senior archaeologist for Olniwe, and so could you tell us a little bit about the organization and what your role and the role of archaeology is in those initiatives?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So Olniwe is still a fairly young organization. It was established in 2019 by the Ebequit Assembly of Councils, which hereafter I will refer to as the EAC. The EAC consists of the chiefs and counselors of both bands. And so for those of you who don't know, there is one First Nation in PEI, and it's organized into two bands, the Lennox Island First Nation and the Ebequit First Nation, as the Mi'kmaq are the sole Indigenous group on PEI. And so Olniwe is one of two organizations that's under the umbrella or the leadership of the EAC. And the other organization is the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI, and their area of responsibility is the provision of, so the other organization under the leadership of the EAC is the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI, and their responsibility is the provision of services and programs to the PEI Mi'kmaq First Nations. And so We have separate but complementary roles under the EAC, and you can kind of think of us as the civil service for the First Nations in PEI. And so under the EAC's direction, we at Ulnaway focus on the advancement and implementation and protection of Mi'kmaq, Aboriginal, and Treaty rights in PEI. And so in terms of the role of archaeology, you know, as I do, that archaeology or archaeological knowledge sometimes plays quite a key role in establishing a strength of claim for the assertion or claim of Aboriginal rights and title in Canada. And so as the rights-based initiative under the EAC, Ulnaway was assigned the responsibility for leading the management of archaeological heritage and also a research program on behalf of the two bands.
Yeah, so there's sort of a two-part approach where there's kind of a research side of things, but it's also feeding into this larger treaty rights and probably like land claims and various other sort of legal proceedings as well, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So we, in archaeology, now there's three of us in archaeology. So there's myself as the senior archaeologist. There's also Aaron Montgomery, who's also an archaeologist and works as our GIS specialist. And we've also recently hired a Mi'kmaq monitor and archaeological assistant. So we work to support colleagues. We have a multidisciplinary team at Ulnaway. We have historians and policy specialists and other expertise in our organization. And so together we work to grow and build that strength of claim for the assertion of.
Yeah. And Aaron, if I'm not mistaken, was also with you in the PEI government office. Is that correct?
She was. And we were very lucky to be able to bring her along into this role.
That's awesome. So on that, you've had a long engagement in PEI archaeology. In broad terms, what is the archaeological record like in PEI, and are there particular research topics that Ulnaway are focused on right now?
Yeah. So the archaeological record on PEI is basically the same as the rest of the Maritime Peninsula, and it's interpreted using the same framework that begins back in the post-glacial era right through to the recent historic period. And all of those chronological periods in between are represented in the archaeological record on the island. And in PEI, we actually have quite a long history of archaeological inquiry here. And in the late 19th century, we had some pretty prolific individuals who, antiquarians, who were had this intellectual curiosity about the past, and they formed the Natural History Society of PEI. And of course, they were sort of instrumental in starting to document the archaeological heritage here, and they built up a fairly sophisticated knowledge about it. And then by 1894, we have our first professional excavation. The American archaeologist, Jesse Fuchs, who shows up here on a vacation and ends up digging at the Rustico Island site because he had, on his vacation, had met some of the local antiquarians, got to talking, and they started showing him sites. And he ended up kind of doing a spontaneous dig at Rustico Island. So an archaeological interest goes way back on PEI. And of course, then it continues through the generations with archaeologists coming here out from outside the province and doing work. And by now we have nearly 400 sites in the register of archaeological sites that the province maintains. And at least half of those are Indigenous and ancestral Mi'kmaq, which, you know, considering the long history of the Mi'kmaq and their ancestors in this area going back at least 12,600 years, you'd think that there would be more of an archaeological record. If I did the math on that before we met today, and I calculated that the Indigenous people have been here 42 times as long as settlers have. We'll probably be talking about this a little later in our conversation, but of course we've lost a lot of that archaeological heritage for various reasons over the years.
Yeah. And I think PEI is sort of interesting. We've talked about this on the show before, but it's not just recent loss. Like PEI as a landmass used to be much larger. And so there's actually a whole record of that would be sort of, I guess, part PEI, part Nova Scotia, part New Brunswick, that's submerged now under the Northumberland Strait. And so there's probably, you know, I know that there's been a history of archaeology thinking about what these past landscapes would look like. And I believe it's somewhere between about 5 and 11,000 years ago sort of thing. And you've written about that too.
Yes, yes, we have. And yeah, no, it's quite true. PEI has you know, only took shape as an island about 5,000 years ago in the wake of the retreating glaciers and all of the environmental and landscape changes that took place. So indeed, at one point, PEI was joined to the mainland by a land bridge.
So to go back to your comment about some of the early archaeology there, I guess it's something, and I think Gabe probably would have picked up on this if he was here, because I know that he's sort of interested in the antiquarian archaeology and the early archaeology in the region. And so you've got Fuchs coming up from the States, and probably, I'm guessing there's some connection between the PEI natural history folks and the group of people that were working in New Brunswick around that time. But I know one of the things that kind of motivated early archaeology, so G.F. Matthews, was this, were middens, like shell-bearing sites. And so was Fuchs looking at the same kind of, from the same angle, that there was this sort of fascination with these shell-bearing sites on the coast? Or was it something in particular that he had read that drew him to PEI? Or was this, like, quite literally, he was on vacation and decided to pick up a shovel?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So back at that time, so Fuchs was in Boston at the time. And at that time, PEI was already, what do they call it, like a destination tourism site. People were coming here, or tourism destination site. People were coming here because of the presumed health benefits of the sea air. So it was quite popular to come to PEI at that time. And as it happens, Fuchs had been undergoing some, I think, personal challenges at the time and was in need of some kind of a getaway. And so I'm speculating here, but I'm thinking maybe a trip to PEI was therapeutic. Certainly he was staying at the Seaside Hotel on the North Shore, which is no longer there, but was connected. I think the owner of the Seaside Hotel was actually John Newsom, who was another local antiquarian. We know that it was just happenstance that he started talking to these guys when they figured out who he was. The conversation was happening, and the next thing he knows, he's being taken out by these guys for tours, shell midden sites. And so, yeah, and so the work that he did, he did publish. So, but we don't know where the artifacts ended up. But yeah, it was definitely just that he happened to be here. He happened to encounter the right people, and the magic happened, and he went out and excavated the midden site, which
part of his healing journey.
Exactly.
So, and you know, the archaeology of him is probably like, you know, those little case bottles with that stuff that's got like arsenic
That's right.
So shifting gears a little bit, there's been some recent media. There's a Globe and Mail article, Saltwire article. I think CBC did some coverage of it as well. That described last summer, I believe it was, the discovery of a human jawbone near Stanhope by a swimmer. So this is a member of the public that identified it. The jaw was later radiocarbon dated to around 5,000 years ago. And this is a fairly significant discovery. So did you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's unique, I think, in a PEI sense, but it's also very unique in the Maritimes and more broadly in Canada because of the engagement that your office is doing and working with human remains, which isn't very common these days.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting story for sure. This mandible fragment was found by a swimmer. So out there at Cove Head, there's a very, very strong current that runs through a channel there out into the Gulf. So it comes from Cove Head Bay and it shoots out into the Gulf at high speed. I wouldn't go near it with a 10-foot pole. It looks really scary. But people will jump off the wharf, sort of be catapulted out into the Gulf, sort of as recreation.
Strong swimmer.
This brave young lad was doing this, enjoying this activity. And as he was wading out of the water, he saw this very small mandible fragment under the water. I really don't even know how he saw it. It's quite small, and it's partial. So it's one side of the of the mandible. So it's, it doesn't have any teeth or anything. So it was quite small. Anyway, so he picked it up and he did recognize what it was, and he turned it over to the RCMP, and their first order of operations is to have it dated. And so they, when they realized how old it was, they turned it over to the Mi'kmaq. And I was provincial archaeologist at the time. And so the Mi'kmaq brought it to me and asked if I would study it on their behalf, because they were very interested to know more about it. So that's what happened. And part of what we did was we worked with Dr. Tanya Peckman at St. Mary's University in Halifax. And because the mandible was fragmentary and no teeth, there wasn't a lot that she could say about it, but she was able to identify it as. So that's nice to know in itself. So being so small, there's not, as you know, as much anatomical features that you can look at. So, but it's really fun because this adds kind of a human dimension to the archaeological story, which is always nice to have. And especially when you think that this is a biologically female person who lived on the island 5,000 years ago, was at the North Shore at a time when the North Shore would have looked quite different than it does today. At that time, it would have been about 3 kilometers further out, for instance, than it is now.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering you know, was this a land, like, would this have been a coastal site at the time that it was occupied, or would this have been a little bit more inland?
Well, it depends where it came from. Like, that's a good question, because we do know, you know, through some scientific studies that have been done on PEI, recreating paleo shorelines, that the shoreline was probably about 3 kilometers out from where it is today. But when we study the mandible, we can see that it had its soil stained. So it was interred at one time in a proper burial site. But then it also has evidence of sun bleaching. So it was unearthed somehow, exposed to a while, or for a while, to the sun. But it doesn't have any evidence of water wear, and it's not waterlogged, and all the alveola for the teeth are still quite sharp-edged. So we know that it wasn't rolling around in the water for a long time. So I don't think that it came out of a submerged context 3 kilometers offshore. So yes, it seems like maybe it was buried much further inland. So it's intriguing, because as I mentioned at Cove Head, we've got right where the swimmer picked it up, the currents are very complicated. They're of all that stretch of North Shore, they get the most complicated right there, and they get very jumbled and going in all directions. There's sort of a broader pattern of movement along the shore that indicates it might have come in from a deposit to the east. But once it gets there, everything starts turning around. So it remains a bit of a mystery where it might have come from. There's also archaeological sites. The Rustico Island site is nearby. There's a few sites in around Cove Head Bay and some surface collections that indicate there might be some deposits, or have been some deposits, that date to the same era. But as yet, we haven't been able to find anything else.
Interesting. Yeah. And so this is probably more likely a recently eroded burial, or comes from a recently eroded burial. And so, you know, I think this and many, you know, this find and probably other finds, like other finds of human remains and artifacts, are increasing in frequency because PEI is facing these massive erosion challenges, right? And so this is, you know, I think, you know, you were the president of the CAA and picked up the, I think you were the president when we signed when the climate change statement came out. You know, this is alarming to archaeologists throughout the world, certainly in North America and definitely in Canada, where we have these massive coastlines. And so there's probably a range of views on how erosion to coastal sites is going on. You know, among them probably, you know, thinking about what's the value of studying human remains, but also at a community level, what's the impact of these losses? And so
For Elnoe generally, what are the concerns around erosion? What are some initiatives that they want to see done? Like, what's the work that you guys are working on right now, documenting or kind of thinking about long-term heritage management, really, in PEI with this, you know, rapid change in climate and rapid erosion?
Yeah. No, it's a good point. And, you know, this is this ties directly into our mandate. You know, we're here to support the Mi'kmaq in the area of Aboriginal rights and title, and the loss of archaeological heritage, of course, is a loss of information. It's a loss of evidence. So it's really important that we have a good understanding of what's happening out there and what's being lost, as you say, at an alarming rate. And I've found in my experience that the way that erosion happens is, you know, there's a fairly steady rate of erosion happening constantly, and then you'll get a big storm and suddenly you've lost 30 feet of shoreline in an area or something. So these things are, I always say that, you know, it's a little difficult to take on Mother Nature, even when humans are the ones causing these problems. We can't anticipate it when they're going to happen. And as for how the community feels about it, obviously I can't speak for the community. And you're absolutely correct that there are a range of views within any group as to whether archaeological sites should be left to return to nature, or should some sort of aggressive action be taken to get out and document the sites before they disappear. And for our part, we're of the view that we need to take a balanced approach and prioritize where we can. Our research agenda, being tied to the Aboriginal Rights Initiative, brings our focus to historic period or proto-historic era sites on PEI. Yeah, and so we are, I'm not sure, I don't want to take up too much time going into it, but with the assertion of Aboriginal title, First Nations and other Indigenous groups have to show that that they had exclusive use and occupation of an area since the time of the assertion of British sovereignty. And then to assert or claim Aboriginal rights, they have to show the use of a particular resource at a particular area since before contact with Europeans. So it's quite stringent, the evidentiary requirements. So we recognize that this area of historical archaeology, particularly of historical Mi'kmaq sites, is a kind of an understudied area in PEI, and maybe
I think at a regional scale, you could say that, really. and it's complicated too, right? Like, I think we've talked about this on the show before, that, you know, it's hard to date some of these sites, and you have challenges with disturbance and everything.
Exactly. So. There's no fault anywhere. There's lots of good reasons why there's a bit of a gap in our record there. And one of our challenges too, I think, is that sometimes sites that have been identified as historic European could also possibly be historic Mi'kmaq. And I've come across, to give credit where it's due, I've come across site reports in PEI where the archaeologists contemplate that and say, well, you know, we have this 18th century site, we've got this, but, you know, this could equally be historic Mi'kmaq. So to the point about climate change, one of our strategies here has always been not only to be looking for places where new sites are eroding out, but also to revisit sites that were documented in the past and see how they're doing and do they even still exist. And oftentimes we haven't been able to find some of these sites that were identified previously. And so part of that is this climate change and rising sea levels and all of the impacts of that, the fact that sometimes we don't have enough ice in the water when the heavy storms hit in the winter, and we see intensified storms, and then we get, you know, a Fiona or a Dorian or something.
You have these one-off massive hurricanes and storms that, you know, seem to always coincide with like a high, you know, the extreme high tide and everything like that.
Exactly.
Too.
When I was working on the Acadian site around 2010, up at Low Point in PEI, we had three nor'easters hit the first three Saturdays of December that year. And it took out 15 to 30 feet of the shoreline right there, just in one quick, you know, episode. So it can be devastating. And also the other thing that happens with these big storms too is that it also causes great sediment dumping. So it may also obscure archaeological sites just by dumping a whole heap load of sand right on top of the evidence.
Yeah, sort of exposes and rips apart one site and then completely buries
exactly.
something else.
Exactly. So, and then the third factor that we're dealing with, of course, is the constant surface collection by archaeological enthusiasts who also are removing evidence from our shorelines. So that's also part of it. But I think,
with that, something actually that I hadn't thought about asking before is, when it comes to development projects and cultural resource management archaeology in PEI, is El Nue engaged as part of that process? And what is their role in sort of reviewing archaeological work that's going on? So beyond climate impacts, there are also development impacts that I'm sure are something that your office handles as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, on PEI, of course, climate change is on everybody's mind because, you know, we're an island that can be severely populated or impacted by this. I think even in terms of something like the salination of the water table, you know, very pragmatic concerns like that. So the province is very tuned in to climate change for sure. Sorry, what was the rest of your question? I got distracted.
And it was just thinking about your role in the cultural resource.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that was sort of a segue to that. So we. Yes, absolutely. We have El Nue has a consultation unit, and so they lead our interaction with the different levels of government in terms of the duty to consult. And usually bundled into that, if it's going to happen, comes the environmental assessment process, and then with that, perhaps an archaeological assessment process. And so we work with our consultation unit to provide archaeological information and support in the conversations with the province and the federal government, and even sometimes municipalities, in terms of assessing the archaeological potential at a property or a project, and then being able to provide our views in terms of what sort of mitigation or preventative strategies might take place.
Okay. So I'm cognizant of the time don't want to keep you a whole lot longer, but I did have one question. So we're, you know, on the cusp of June. Sounds like the weather's getting better in PEI. Other than some of the response work that you guys are doing, monitoring sites and going to revisit them, do you have any current research projects or field plans for the summer? Are you guys, I know you've been working on a site in, I believe it's Malpec? Or had been. So what's your field season looking like?
Yeah, well, this field season, we have a couple of projects planned, two or three projects planned, actually. One is at Savage Harbor, and we were out there recently, actually, with Christian Terrio, because we were looking together for a suitable place to get some samples. I'm interested. We've been working very hard to expand the radiocarbon database for PEI, and so I'm very interested in finding some in situ samples that we can date. And so we went out together to look at that recently. And anyway, the way that ended up was that there are some intact deposits on a property that's owned by the Catholic Church. And it turns out that this property has a bit of site eroding out from it, pre-contact site right onto the beach at Savage Harbor. But it's a fantastic site because it's also got there's pre-deportation Acadian in that immediate area, and there's also the site of a family that came over to Prince Edward Island in 1772 on the Alexander. with 214 Scottish Catholic Highlanders that were brought over and settled here. And so this family came over as part of that group, and they settled Tracadie Bay and then kind of spread out from there. And but then this family came. They had eight children, but one son stayed back in Scotland. Sorry, I don't know if I mentioned it was from Scotland. They came, the one came from Scotland, was left in Scotland, where he was studying to be a priest. And when he was of age, he came to PEI too and became a very beloved priest on Prince Edward Island. His name was Bishop Angus MacEachran. And so his parents built a house on this property in 1772, and then he built one around 1790. So this property is just full of potential, and we're collaborating with Dr. Jonathan Fowler from St. Mary's University. He came over a couple of weekends ago, and we did some geophysical on that property, and also at another property where we're called the Glen Allerdale Estate, which is actually where those Scottish Highlanders first came to in 1772. And it happens to sit on an old Mi'kmaq portage route that joins Tracadie Bay to the Hillsborough River. It's also got pre-deportation Acadian there as well. So that we've got these two sites that we're looking at, and hopefully the beginning of an interesting collaboration with Jonathan. And then, yes, we are just getting ready to do an excavation at Ram Island in Malpeque Bay, which is historical records tell us that this was sort of the seat of occupation for the Mi'kmaq in the 1730s thereabout. So it's a little tiny island, and priests recorded that the Mi'kmaq were cultivating corn there, and that they actually, yeah, they produced quite a bit, apparently. So now whether, you know, we always have to take with a pinch of salt what those priests said back then, because they were kind of talk up what they were, their success. But the Mi'kmaq, the historical name for the site, which is a long word that I can't pronounce, but the Mi'kmaq did refer to it as sort of the old cultivating grounds there. So,
wow.
And on the adjacent mainland, the historical records tell us that that's where the mission was, and it was only one of three missions in the Maritimes at the time. And there was a mission there, so the priests were coming and sometimes staying with the Mi'kmaq over the winter. And the Mi'kmaq were said to have a council house there where they'd have meetings, and that the council house was surrounded by wigwams, and it would be under the site of the present-day Princetown United Church. So unfortunately, we can't test right there, but all around there, we've been working at some other places and finding evidence of 18th century Mi'kmaq occupation. So we're really hoping to get out to Ram Island soon. We're just working on the permissions to get out there.
That sounds like a totally fascinating summer.
Yes, so,
and I'm teaching a contacts archaeology course this fall, and I might pencil you in to maybe have to share some of the contact period archaeology that's going on in PEI. That would be really fascinating.
Yeah, it's a great subject to be studying. I'm really, really enjoying it, and of course we get to dip into the of course the historical records and the maps and oral histories, and it just really brings the history alive. And one of the craziest things, like living in a small place like PEI, is that I'll be looking at, you know, at a record from the early 1700s or late 1700s, looking for a Mi'kmaq reference, but I'll come across the reference to the Scottish Highlanders or the Quakers or something. Like, everything's connected. Like, the history is all connected, and I really find interesting when somebody shows up on the page that, like, hey, you're not supposed to be part of this story, but there you are. And so it's really fun doing this research.
Very cool. Well, that's I really appreciate you coming on today and sharing the information, and looking forward to continuing the conversation, and we'll have to have you on again, maybe to talk some post-contact stuff.
That sounds true. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, Ken, I think it's time for Hit Pieces.
I believe it is.
Well, so Ken, we've got an exciting series of hit pieces here. We've got two, and we're going to start off, I think, with the Society for American Archaeology Geoarchaeology Task Force statement on deep testing for terrestrial sites and professional qualifications for geoarchaeologists in cultural resource management in the U.S. And so what this is the SAA, Society for American Archaeology, as we just said, has a kind of interest group on geoarchaeology. And what they have noticed, basically, I think we've talked a little bit about contexts in which people might do mechanical testing using augers on to basically get at very deep buried landforms. I think that might have been a hit piece we've done, maybe the Paleo Digger, Ken.
Yeah, I think we talked about it, and yeah, we talked about it, and the sort of the lecture series that they gave, or maybe it was just one lecture that I've seen multiple times. But they did a paper at ESAF as well, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah,
they did.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Maybe that's what came out of. So,
excellent. Yeah. And so anyway, but this is sort of interesting. There's two prongs to this. Basically, one of them is talking about situations in which this group thinks folks should be using those sorts of, you say, like mechanical augers to test particular landforms. And then the other aspect of it is what they think should be qualifications for geoarchaeologists working on like cultural resource management projects. So similar to the way that there's qualifications for pre-contact archaeologists, historic archaeologists, and architectural historians in the States, they'd like geoarchaeology to be a recognized specialty.
And they draw attention, too, to the inconsistency across the United States and the way that this is applied. There's sort of a couple of very helpful color-coded maps that kind of show you how scattershot some of this is.
Yes, there are. And there's not a lot of rules out there about geoarchaeology, listener, it turns out.
Yeah.
And in addition to this, they also have a kind of section where they have some critiques of predictive modeling as currently implemented. And they argue that most predictive models are applied to whole jurisdictions and are too imprecise to be very useful because the landforms are not resolved at an appropriate enough level.
Which has been the critique of like potential and predictive models in the Maritimes as well, that they're too generalized and that they really predictive models are meant to be highly localized.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, Ken, I understand. So we'll put that in the show notes. We highly recommend that the listener check that out. I believe it's just like a link. It's just basically a PDF you can find online.
Yeah, it's just an online document. It's like 10 pages and pretty quick read. It's a good like technical document and something, too, that I'm sure lots of folks working in the CRM sector would be interested in.
Yeah, and I suspect we're going to see more about this. It seems like this is kind of a starting point, and it must be a conversation that these folks are having. I don't actually know. I think I've had lunch once with one of the guys, Bill Chadwick, on this paper, but that's really it. I don't know the other folks, but it's a range of maybe, you know, 10 or a dozen authors.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't recognize any of the names myself, but most of them are from the consulting industry.
Yep, that's right. And you also have an open access one today.
Yeah, yeah. And also, and kind of interestingly, sort of in the same vein, is kind of thinking critically about practice stuff that we do in archaeology. And this one is an article by Arlie Lyman in the most recent SAA Archaeological Record. So that's volume 25, number 3, May 2025, pages 27 to 29, I believe, 31, sorry. It's called On the Number of Authors Per Article in American Antiquity and Author Contributions. And so this is, I guess, the second in a series of things that Lyman's been kind of breaking down stats in American Antiquity and the journals that the Society for American Archaeology publish.
He seems like a man who perhaps nearing retirement remembered that he had a file recording lots of information about his own publication experience.
Right. And I think probably somebody who enjoys stats and you know, all of these digital databases are now at access to somebody who's good and enjoys doing stats probably makes, is fun for some people. Not
Absolutely.
For me, but I'm glad these people are around so that I can, we can be colleagues and they can help me with statistics.
Absolutely. We should note that this is a sole-authored article about
it is,
multi-authored
exactly.
articles.
Exactly. It's sole-authored. Yeah. And he's talking about what's interesting is a pattern that shows the decrease since the 1940s in sole authorship of articles, particularly in the American Antiquity Journal. And with that, the a correlation with an increase in the multi-authored and an increase overall in the numbers of authors per article over time, and sort of hits its peak in the 1970s when he kind of ties it into processualism. And so this is a theoretical change in archaeology where you have people bringing in multidisciplinarity into a lot of projects. So it's a natural, it is a correlation. It's not necessarily a causation, but it is kind of like there's definitely a link there. But he also draws attention to...
That's the moment at which people needed to bring in Arlie Lyman and people like that to do their stats.
Exactly, exactly. Now, one of the things he draws attention to that's kind of important for somebody who's in my position, for example, pre-tenure, is how different institutions view the authorship. And so, some people are under greater scrutiny to understand what your contribution was on a multi-authored paper. And essentially what his pitch is that he would like the Society for American Archaeology journals to start to use what's sometimes called credit. Yeah, and I don't know if that's the only one, but that's kind of the standard. And I actually don't know what the acronym is for. I forgot to highlight that. I don't know if he spells it out in this one or not, but
essentially... He does somewhere, I think, but...
But essentially what credit is that each person... who contributes to an author actually has to make a statement and tick a whole bunch of boxes about what they did. And so the idea is if you're the first author, you've done most of the writing on this, you've managed most of the revisions, you've done most of the data analysis. You may have shipped out parts of that data analysis to somebody else, but essentially the ideas and the writing have been mostly your contribution, right? And the credit authorship is a way of basically being accountable for what your contribution was to a paper, which is something that people want to make sure of so that you don't have things like gift authorship, which is essentially somebody gets added to a paper and hasn't really contributed to it because that's not how the scholarly paper process works in our discipline.
Yep, absolutely. And he specifically gives a kind of example of, I believe the hook for the article is basically him talking about being on someone's, I had a tenure promotion committee or something, and there being a negative outcome because it was difficult to determine what this person had actually done on all of their papers.
Yeah, exactly. And he said he's been on a number of these tenure reviews, and you know, this the topic of what a person's contribution comes up quite frequently, but it can have a negative outcome. And so essentially people can't figure out if the person who is reviewing your tenure file can't figure out specifically what you did on this paper, if you're, you know, one of 12 people on there, for example, they can't really give you credit for that that paper in the same way that if it's a solo authored or one that you can actually claim, and your colleagues have also claimed what their contributions were.
Yeah, and so his argument would be, I guess, it's a particularly important, you know, for the Society for American Archaeology, which, you know, presumably if someone has a American Antiquity paper on their CV, it's an important part of their tenure case.
Exactly, yeah. It's a top-tier journal, and at least in archaeology is considered to be, and so should probably have these kinds of accountability measures put in place.
Absolutely. All right, Ken. Well, I think you need to get ready for the field. I'm in the field. And on that note, we're probably going to leave the listener here, and we're going to warn them that there may be, we're going to do our best to not have too many interruptions in programming, but we are entering that summer season where we've been known to make a four-night into a five-night or a six-night even, I would say.
Yeah, I think this was a fortnight and a half when this drops, and so
yes,
that might be the pattern for
an
the summer.
Fortnight.
But I think the next time they hear from us, we'll be getting some dispatches from Southern Maine, yes. And we'll also be, I will be in New Brunswick, I think, probably next time we record anything.
That's great.
Yeah, it'll be the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast, partially from New Brunswick. And then at some point, we'll see each other in New Brunswick.
That's right. So if you're listening in and you're a waitress at the Rogue, if you could just set aside a booth for us for this,
exactly.
This would be good.
Yeah, yeah, we should bring the microphones to the Rogue for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's essential. All right, Ken. Well, good talking to you, and we'll see you soon.
Yep. Be safe in the field, and hope things go a little bit smoother this week than last week.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon, listener.
Talk to you soon, listener.